I wanted to introduce our speaker today. He's Paul Barnett, who is a health economist and founding director of the Health Economics Resource Center. He's also part of the VA HSN R&D Center in Palo Alto, the Center for Innovation to Implementation. He is a consulting associate professor in the Department of Health Research and Policy at Stanford, and he received his graduate training at the University of California at Berkeley. So today he'll be talking about his work as an economist on several clinical trials which were conducted by the VA Cooperative Studies Program and the Treatment Research Center at UCSF. So, Paul, I'll turn things over to you now.
Thanks, Jean, for the introduction. And, Heidi, I must confess that when I clicked the button that says show my screen, it all went blank.
I thought something might have happened because I can just see you're connected to GoToWebinar screen. Do you still have access? Did your PowerPoint shut down, it looks like?
Yeah, that's what it looks like to me.
Okay, so I apologize
for the technical problems here.
Yeah, apologies to the audience. Just bear with us for just a moment, and we will get everything going in just a moment here.
So so no one is seeing anything. It's not just me.
Everyone is seeing your screen, so we can see the connected to GoToWebinar.
I see.
So do you have your PowerPoint available to pull back up?
I do. I can go get it, but everybody's going to have to see my
As long as you don't have anything embarrassing or disparaging coming up, we'll be okay with that.
Let's see.
Just remember, we are recording this.
Okay, the pressure is on. Wait a minute. So this is, but this is a web browser, and my PowerPoint I can get.
You want to go right there.
I see. Okay. I thought that you ordinarily put up the
nope, we
slide.
We switched webinar services. You know, we do that once a year just to keep you guys on your phone.
Okay, sorry to fumble about here because I wasn't expecting to have to do this. And it's, of course... Okay, my apologies for this little delay.
And once you put it up in slideshow mode, we should be good to go.
Now, do you see it now?
I can see it. If you put it into slideshow mode, it will fill my screen.
Yes. Normal, but wait a minute. Nope. That's view...
A little bit over to the right, slideshow. Nope, over to the right and up a little bit. Up.
Oh, there we go.
There we go.
Sorry. From beginning. Good. Sorry. Okay. So I apologize for that little bit of delay. I want to talk today about the topic of cost-effectiveness analyses of smoking cessation in some trials that we did with patients who have psychiatric illness. I want to first acknowledge some great help that I've had from a Stanford grad student, Aubrey Jeffers, who helped with the modeling. And with the various investigators who did these smoking cessation trials, and my collaborator Sonia Duffy in Ann Arbor, but also the VA investigators in the Cooperative Studies program, and also the folks that I work with at the University of California, San Francisco Treatment Research Center, who've done three of the four trials that I'm going to talk about today. So the overview of the presentation is I want to first just review the problem of smoking in populations that have psychiatric illness. Talk a little bit about how we establish the value of smoking cessation interventions and consider if they're worth doing. Some of the methods that we used in all four trials and then the findings from these studies. And then finally just some discussion of areas of future study on this topic. So first just to talk about this issue about smoking in people with psychiatric illness. It really is a big problem in this population, which has very high prevalence rates, and I've listed some of them that are known about folks with schizophrenia and bipolar disorder, veterans with post-traumatic stress disorder, and these rates are much higher than the 18% rate of people who do not have a mental health diagnosis. So increasingly, tobacco use is a problem of people with psychiatric problems. And it's not just the prevalence that's the issue, it's also that they smoke more heavily, and that is more cigarettes per day. And in fact, it's been estimated that almost half of cigarette consumption in the United States is by people that have some mental illness. And of course, we know that the health impacts of smoking are serious, but it's interesting to note that in people with mental illness, they have very high mortality risks. In schizophrenia, about 2.5 times the mortality that's expected for their age and gender. And a lot of that extra mortality is due to the risk from smoking, from that high smoking prevalence rate. And it's been noted that the smokers with schizophrenia have more than two times the mortality risk of non-smokers with schizophrenia. So some big part of that 2.5 times mortality risk is due to tobacco use. Same issue, veterans with PTSD have 2.1 times the mortality risk that would be expected for age and gender. But after we adjust for smoking status, it's only about 26% higher. So really, smoking is a big part of the extra mortality risk. It's not just trauma or accident or suicide. It's the cigarettes. And so I want to diverge here a little bit, and Heidi, get your help with this, and ask a poll question just to help me direct the focus of the talk and find out if the people attending that are most interested in the question about smoking cessation, or are they more interested in hearing about the methods that we use in the economic evaluation, sort of see this as a worked example.
Sounds good. Responses are coming in. We'll give everyone just a few more moments before I close the poll question out. They're slowly coming in. I don't want to close it out yet because we're definitely still getting more responses in. And it looks like we're slowing down. So what we are seeing is 43% are here for the smoking cessation services and 57% for the methods for economic evaluation. Thank you, everyone, for participating.
Well, that is helpful. That's interesting. I didn't know which way it would turn out, so that's a very interesting one. So some slight predilection to the methods part. Well, we won't ignore the other question, but this is really, the next section really is about some of the methodology of doing cost-effectiveness analysis. So how do we assign a value? That is, how do we trade off the costs with the benefits of a smoking cessation program? And so what do we mean by value is really kind of a cost per unit of benefit. And we talk about an incremental cost-effectiveness ratio where we compare our intervention to standard care, and we say, what is the increase in costs, and divide that by the increase of benefits, and that way yield a cost per unit of benefit. And that is some novel change in care relative to the way the world is now. And so in smoking cessation, people have found, what's the cost per quit? And there's a nice natural unit to measure. So for each extra person that is quit smoking, how much does it cost to achieve that? And obviously you have to treat many people to get one to quit. And this review that's now 10 years out of date, but by Ronkers, found that the median cost of 14 cost-effective studies was $13,000 per quit. Well, a problem with a cost-effectiveness ratio like that that's enumerated in some natural unit of outcome is we don't really know what society was willing to pay for a quit. And so what the standard method of cost-effectiveness analysis is to, instead of using some natural unit like quit, is to put the value in quality-adjusted life year. And I won't get into the details of that. You can learn that from our course, but it's basically looking at life years of survival and adjusting it for the effects of comorbidities and their effect on quality of life on a scale that is where zero is death and one is perfect health. And in the United States, we tend to approve interventions that cost less than $100,000 per quality. That is, they generate an additional quality-adjusted life year at a cost less than $100,000. And in the World Health Organization says, in general, that it's about the threshold for what gets approved in different countries is about the per capita gross domestic product. So in the U.S., we're a little bit higher than that. That's not our GDP, but per capita GDP, but that's a general rule of thumb worldwide, what health systems are willing to afford. And so this has been done for a number of smoking cessation studies. I've listed some here, and you can see that the cost-effectiveness ratios are actually quite quite low in the under $5,000 by and large. Now, some of these are a little out of date, and we should adjust for, I think these actually are adjusted to $2,010 dollars, but well below the $100,000 per quali. And in fact, it's a good argument to make that smoking cessation is one of the most cost-effective things we can do in the healthcare system, just because the payoff is so great. Now, for psychiatric patients, cost-effectiveness has not been studied, and we have found other than the studies that I'm going to present today that we've been involved in. And there's reason to think that it might be different, that smoking cessation may be less cost-effective in psychiatric settings or with psychiatric patients than for other patients in other settings. And that's simply because the people who have psychiatric illness are less likely to quit, so we're going to have to spend more resources to get them to quit. And they're more likely to relapse, so the benefit of quitting may be less. And it may also be less because they have a lower quality of life and they have a higher risk of death from non-smoking causes. So they are going to get fewer life years, even if they do quit, because there's this competing risk. So talk a little bit about the methods that we employed in some trials to look at various smoking cessation interventions. And what I'll talk about here is how we measure costs, and there's three methods that I briefly listed there. I'll get into detail in just a minute. How did we determine quality of life, and then how did we consider the long-term effects of the intervention? Trial follow-up only goes for so long, and we need to know what's the payoff over the long term. So take each of these in turns. A critical thing is to figure out exactly what the intervention, in this case the smoking cessation services, cost. And that's not easy to find. We can't just pull that off of some charge schedule or a cost report. We've really got to actively measure that, usually by taking some sort of survey of the staff that are involved in delivering the intervention, finding out their labor costs, looking at the supplies like the various pharmacotherapies used, the equipment space, all of those things that go into delivering the intervention. So that is a micro-costing or a direct measurement method that's used. And then for other healthcare costs in these trials, we've used claims data, or we call in VA administrative data, to get information on the cost of care in the system where the patient was enrolled. And I've listed the systems that are involved in these trials. We had a multi-site VA trial, but also the University Hospital, San Francisco County system, Kaiser Permanente was also a site for one of the trials. When we get charge data, of course, from some of these non-VA systems, we have to adjust that by the ratio of cost to charges, because charges are much higher than the actual cost of care. Hospital cost reports are one source of information about how to scale the charges back so that they more approximate what it actually costs to produce the care. Now, the claims data are not comprehensive because the patients get care in other systems outside of the place where they're enrolled, and so we have questionnaires, ask patients to self-report the care that they got outside their system. It's always a struggle to distinguish what we mean by outside the system where they were enrolled. In some of the trials, we've actually obtained the hospital bills for the inpatient stays. And the reason we do that is, and get charge data from that, is because it's very hard to estimate what a hospitalization costs just based on the number of days of stay or what limited information a patient can recall. Fortunately, the stays are usually rare enough that it's possible to gather this information. Otherwise, if the patient reports a count of visits or emergency room stays or days in residential care, this sort of thing, we use unit costs that are based either on a reimbursement schedule or some information that we're getting from claims data. So that's the second, or the third leg, excuse me, of the costing data, the self-report. I want to turn to the quality of life measures. These are quality of well-being. We used in one study Health Utilities Index in another study. We have also used when those types of scales, which are designed for economic evaluation, if they're not available, we have been able to make do with data from the respondents to the SF-12 quality of life survey, that short form 12, very standard method for looking at health outcomes, but is not a preference-based utility measure, can't use directly for qualities. There's a way, a method developed by Brazier, and that allows you to take the SF-12 responses and create a utility estimate out of that. We did that for one trial. And the issue is that we don't want to assume that our participants had perfect health, and especially in this case of people with psychiatric illness, that seems like a very bad assumption indeed to make. Now, the issue with an intervention like smoking is costs are incurred at the outset, but the benefits might not be realized until years in the future in terms of longer survival or avoided smoking-related illness. And so we're not going to observe that in the time frame of the trial. So what we did is built a Markov model to project that long-run effect of smoking status, given the age and gender distribution of the trial participants, and of course their smoking status at the end of the trial. And this slide shows as a schematic of that model. And basically, we take information that we have on the end of the trial, how many people in, say, the treatment group were current smokers and former smokers, and then we use information we have about quit and relapse rates and mortality risks to estimate how the number of people in each of these cells change, how many die, and we tally over the period that we run the model, which is basically for the rest of the patient's lifetime, how many years are spent in each health state, that is current smoker or former smoker, and what the costs and quality of life are over that period. And so the point is, we don't want to assume that all the people who were former smokers at the end of the trial remain former smokers forever. They may relapse. And all of the people who did not successfully quit by the end of the trial, they may quit in the future. So we need to allow for those dynamic changes. So the model is run once with the parameters for the intervention group, and it is also run with for the control group, and then we compare the long-term costs and the long-term outcomes between those groups using the model, projecting forward, you know, how many years of life, how many dollars healthcare costs will they incur. So in order to build the model, we need to get some parameters besides the ones that we get from the trial about what did the intervention cost and how successful was it in getting people to quit smoking. And so these are things like the relapse rate among people who've successfully quit, and the quit rates among those who didn't. And I've just noted that in our model, we allow the relapse rate to vary with time since quit, because it's very well observed that the longer someone's quit, the more likely they'll stay quit. And that people who continue to smoke will quit over time, and the older they live, the more likely they are to quit smoking. We also look at the mortality rates for by smoking status, age and gender, and that should be quality of life, sorry not to catch that error, in smokers and former smokers, and those vary by age and gender. And then one weakness, and we'll discuss this a little later, is this information is not surprisingly not as well developed as you would think for the general population of smokers and former smokers, and is especially problematic for the subgroups of psychiatric patients. But we did our best to get plausible parameters for all these values. And the final methodologic point I want to note is how do we handle the certainty of our estimates, both the uncertainty due to the variation we observe in the trial and the uncertainty in the model. We have to have some way of saying, is the result statistically significant. How confident are we in our cost effectiveness findings? And the method we use is probabilistic sensitivity analysis. This is a pretty standard approach where you not only include the variance that is observed in the trial for each parameter, the quit rates and the costs, which are of course affected by sample size and what and just the variation between the trial participants, but also we have to estimate uncertainty about the other model parameters. How certain are we of the confident are we and attach a put a confidence interval for the other model parameters, and then once we have this data assembled, we draw from it repeatedly, 1,000 times in fact, to see and each time generate a new cost effectiveness interval, and then see the distribution of cost effectiveness intervals and how many of them meet our criteria of saying, oh yes, that's cost effective. And typically we're interested in a willingness to pay of $100,000 per quality. How many of them meet that criteria of all these 1,000 replicates? But we also want to try it at other thresholds because the decision maker may have a lower or a higher threshold than that one. So that is how we handle uncertainty. And what I'd like to do now is now turn to some of the details of these four trials, and this is probably more interesting for those of you that are interested in, that want to know about smoking cessation services. So all of these dealt with patients identified in psychiatric settings. One was of smokers identified during a psychiatric hospitalization. Another of smoking veterans who are receiving outpatient treatment for post-traumatic stress disorder. A third was outpatients obtaining treatment for depression in a university clinic. And finally, veterans who were being treated in VA alcohol treatment programs. So the first trial I'd like to talk about is a inpatient study. The smokers were identified in a university psychiatric hospital. There were 223 smokers, all had serious mental illness. And the intervention that we looked at was actually a very simple one. This computer assessment, which we call stepped care. So it assessed the patient's readiness to quit smoking, provided them with tailored feedback given their answers that they gave in this assessment, and a workbook to promote readiness to change. And those people who are ready to set a quit date were given 10 weeks of nicotine replacement therapy. So it's a pretty simple intervention. The control group was given a pamphlet and basically said, you should quit smoking. Very brief advice to quit. And that really is probably more than is traditional. I would say the standard care now is, even though most psychiatric inpatients are given nicotine replacement during their stay, who are smokers, who if they request it, they can't smoke in a hospital these days, they need to get NRT. There's very little done for them in terms of cessation services. This trial's really attempted to address that. So the cost in this case were fairly modest in terms of what it cost to do this intervention in the experimental group. It's worth noting that the control group also reported getting some cessation services. Mental health costs were quite high, and you can see there's no statistically difference between the groups, high degree of variation in different participants. The abstinence rates were quite a 12% difference between the experimental and control groups, so statistically significant. And if we take these costs, the difference in costs of $152 divided by the difference in quit rates of approximately 12%, it runs to $1,271 per quit. So that's quite a bit less than the $3,000 per quit that was found in that meta-analysis. The median cost per quit that's in, I think it was 16 studies. Now, we had some information on the trial other than the cost and the effectiveness. that the average age was about 40 years, that people had quality of life that was about three-quarters of what would be expected for their gender and age. We estimated these from the SF-12 data that were available for this trial. And when we ran our Markov model, we found that the life over the lifetime, the remaining lifetime of the patients, that the treatment group would incur $43 more costs and enjoy 0.1 extra quality-adjusted life years, about a tenth of a quality, and that this is means that the intervention has a cost incremental cost effectiveness ratio of $428 for quality. This is quite a bit lower than almost any healthcare intervention. It's really highly cost effective. And this plot bears a little bit of explanation. So remember I talked about how we do a probabilistic sensitivity analysis. We want to know what percentage of the replicates are in the accept region. And so this is on the left, the y-axis, is the percent of the replicates that are cost-effective. And on the x-axis is the particular threshold that the decision-maker will use to judge cost-effectiveness. And so if you see over on the far right, it's $100,000 per quality. And at that threshold, 99.9% of the replicates are in the accept region. So this is a way of portraying statistical significance that allows the decision maker to use their own threshold willingness to pay. So if the healthcare, even if the healthcare system had a willingness to pay only, say, $25,000 per quality, we can see from the curve that still 95% of the replicates would be in the accept region, and even with that lower threshold, the intervention would be considered statistically significantly worth adopting. This cost-effectiveness acceptability curve is become the standard way of reporting these probabilistic sensitivity analyses, and the big advantage is that the policymaker can use their own threshold willingness to pay, and we can report all the information that's needed in that curve. Different countries, different health systems might have different thresholds. Now, the second trial is the VA cooperative studies that enrolled 943 smokers with post-traumatic stress disorder, and they were motivated to quit, so they had to indicate an intention to quit. In the prior study, it was just all smokers were enrolled, so this was a more rarefied group. And the experimental intervention was integrating smoking cessation services with PTSD care. So the services were provided by the same provider who gave the PTSD care. There were 8 counseling sessions with monthly boosters, both nicotine replacement therapy and possibly other pharmacotherapy, chiefly varenicline. And the control intervention was referral to a VA smoking cessation clinic. And in this case, the cessation services were quite a bit more costly, both in the experimental and control group. Healthcare costs were a similar range of $20,000 a year in the follow-up period, 18-month follow-up period. No difference between groups. And the abstinence rates, you can see, are about 4.4% higher in the experimental group, statistically significant, quite a bit less than we observed in the other trial. So we divide that difference in cost by the difference in outcomes and end up with $17,000 per quit. Now that compares to, remember, in that meta-analysis, $3,000 per quit was the median. So quite a bit more costly, this approach, than it was to get a quit in the general population of smokers. We modeled, these folks were 55 years old, so quite a bit older than the other trial. Quality of life was actually lower, 65% of expected for the given age and gender. And we applied that to our Markov model and generate a cost effectiveness ratio, said that there would be $836 lifetime extra cost and an additional 0.026 qualities, or a $32,000 cost effectiveness per quality, $32,000 cost per each quality generated. So still, this point estimate is within the accept region, but really quite high for a smoking cessation intervention. In fact, I'm not aware of any other smoking cessation intervention that has had a cost effectiveness ratio that is this high. Clearly, there are other trials that have not been effective, not effective yet high. And I think this has something to do with the fact that the trial had so many participants that we had were able to detect a significant effect. Talk a little bit about the implications later on. So this is our cost effectiveness acceptability curve. Just for ease of reading, I've added that line at the $100,000 per quality level. And you can see at that point, we're about 86% of the replicates are in the accept space, which is not statistically significant in our traditional sense. Somehow, in cost effectiveness world, we're willing to accept a little bit larger uncertainty for our results. I think this has to do with the fact that trials are usually powered for effectiveness, not cost effectiveness. That if we had enough participants to be statistically certain of cost effectiveness findings, trials would be very, very expensive to conduct. That said, it's we would have to go up to something like $200,000 to $250,000 willingness to pay threshold before we had could say that we were the result was statistically significant. Now I talk about a third trial that I was involved in. This one is was published in 2008, so this is really the first one in the area, which was a cessation intervention delivered to smokers who were in a university psychiatric clinic being treated for depression. And this also was the stepped intervention where there were three computer assessments in this case, repeated over time, assessing readiness to change, giving the individual tailored feedback and a workbook just like before. Only in this case, if people were ready to quit, they could get up to 6 counseling sessions and 10 weeks of nicotine replacement therapy. Those who have relapsed could also get bupropion, also known as Wellbutrin or Zyban. Those are the trade names. That's a treatment for smoking. The control intervention, intervention, sorry about these spelling errors that spell check doesn't help you with. They received a pamphlet and just simply a list of the smoking cessation programs that might help. And in this group, we had really kind of intermediate between the other two studies in terms of costs between them, the abstinence levels between them, and the mental health costs, of course, quite a bit smaller in this group. And the cost here is $6,200 per quit. In this case, this trial, we did not build a model. We simply used the information from some other models that said there's an error in this. It should be 1.2 life years gained per quit. So we looked at a number of other studies about what they said about what the expected value of a quit is, and we said, well, that's approximately right. What if that were the case in this group? A quit is worth 1.2 life years. We didn't use qualies in that case. And we said that's in a cost-effectiveness ratio of $5,200 per life years. If we translated this into qualies, it would have to be a somewhat bigger number because people do not have perfect quality of life. And we really didn't consider in this study the effect of the mental health on the value of years of life gained. So that is a limitation of the study. The cost effectiveness ratio, though, is still pretty low and typical of that of cost of smoking studies. Now the fourth trial was conducted in VA outpatient alcohol treatment programs. This is the smallest of the four trials, the 162 smokers. And this was a quite an intensive intervention, up to 16 counseling sessions, 24 weeks of nicotine replacement therapy, again, bupropion for relapse. The control intervention was referred to the VA smoking cessation clinic. And our costs were quite high as a consequence. You say $1,600 compared to $25 in the control group. The healthcare costs were also quite high, no statistical difference between groups. And our abstinence rates, while higher in the experimental group, we can't really say that it's higher because there was no statistical significance to that difference. So really a null finding in this case. So I put all the data from all four trials up here just to compare them. And I think the interesting thing is, you know, that dollars per quit from the inpatient stay from $1,200 going up to $17,000 in the PTSD, VA PTSD trial. The dollars per quality, a similar spanning along range. And of course, in the alcohol treatment program, we don't really have anything to say because that cessation service did not work. So I want to talk a little bit about the implications of all this. First, the implications for how we provide smoking services, and then the implications for how we conduct economic analyses. So it's interesting to note that there were kind of two approaches for doing smoking cessation in psychiatric patients. One was to integrate it with their psychiatric care, and the other was to have some sort of separate dedicated service. And in the trials, these trials, it seemed that the dedicated services seemed to work better. But it also may have to do with the nature of the services that were used. And talk a little bit about this last bullet point about that. Then the question in all of these trials is how much services are sufficient. And it's interesting that the more intensive smoking cessation interventions among these four did not necessarily prove to be the most effective ones. There's some, actually very little literature about how much services are indicated. If you think about it, if smoking cessation is so very cost effective, it seems like we could afford to spend more on it, even on a given patient. That, if a brief intervention is highly cost-effective, an extended intervention may also be cost-effective. And so there's some evidence of that, but not very good information about what are the marginal returns to a lot of extra services. So it's interesting in the how much extra counseling I was involved in a different trial. This was of extended care for primary care patients who were older age, and so it's not a psychiatric population, but we found that extra counseling was beneficial and that extra nicotine replacement therapy was not. So this case we were comparing lower level services with more level services. That's a kind of a rare trial. There are not so many been done that way. Interestingly, there's a Cochrane review of this that has found exactly the opposite, that the extended nicotine replacement therapy is better than a short course, but that extended counseling offers no advantage over the lesser amount of counseling. So we found the opposite in our study of the older patients. Not one of the four I discussed here, but it is an interesting question about how much is enough and do we get more benefit from extension of these services. And the other interesting difference is that some of the studies took in all smokers regardless of their intention to quit, and other studies only those who are ready to set a quit date and quit. And it turns out that counterintuitively, those studies that recruited all smokers actually had better success. And this really gets to the last bullet point, which is that the the stage-based counseling is the common denominator between those two studies, one and two, which were highly effective, that they were using this computer expert system to assess patients and try to motivate them to quit, and had counseling that was directed to based on the feedback that they gave to this computer system about just exactly their current thoughts about quitting were. So this seems to be, just based on this very small sample, a good approach. I want to talk a little bit about, as a point of view now, as the economist on the study. I should say that the prior slide should be a little bit of a grain of salt, because I am just the cost-effectiveness guy, not the smoking cessation guy on these studies. But in terms of the economics aspects of it, I think there's an interesting question about some of the results. The differences between these trials had to do with variations in the definition of quit, and in particular the VA trial of post-traumatic stress disorder, cessation service of post-traumatic stress disorder. It used a very rigorous definition of quit, of prolonged abstinence, and the other trials did not use such a rigorous definition, and that most trials do not use that same rigor in defining what constitutes abstinence. All of the studies used biochemical verification, and that does seem to be a standardized method. But the question of whether we're using a point prevalence or a 7-day prevalence or a, you know, not even a puff in the last 18 months, those are not so well standardized between different studies, and not just our studies but other studies as well. The quality of life measures, I think now we're getting to the point where we need to include those in trials. But we found that we were able to do a pretty good job even with having SF-12 available. We were able to make the adjustments we needed. The cost other than cessation services incurred during the trial, you may have noticed that for two trials, we just looked at mental health services and not all costs. And the notion there is that we know that smoking causes other healthcare problems, and we didn't really need, in the context of the trial, to look at the effect of smoking on healthcare costs. But we were concerned that smoking cessation or randomizing people to a smoking cessation program might cause them to incur more mental health care costs. And some people have even speculated that this is a reason not to treat tobacco use in psychiatric populations, that you may make their psychiatric problems worse. And of course, that would increase their psychiatric costs. Well, we found no evidence that in any of these trials that the smoking cessation led to worse psychiatric outcomes, and no evidence that it increased the healthcare costs or psychiatric care costs. The other thing is that we actually, in the end, did not include those the costs of other than the cessation services that we measured in the short term during the trial. And the reason is those costs were so high and variable that it just swamped our cost estimate with those, the variation between patients, especially, you know, when they have $20,000 to $40,000 a year in psychiatric care, and that it's highly variable according to how many times they're hospitalized. That just kind of drowns out all the signal about the cost of the cessation services themselves. And so in the end, we had, we dropped those and acknowledged that we did that because of that problem. So the interesting thing as a model builder is how amazingly poor the data is. You would think that we would have real good information about even such things as how often do smokers quit on their own and how often do recent quitters relapse. There is literature on that, but on relatively small samples and never on psychiatric populations. We just simply had to make assumptions about how those things might change in psychiatric illness, how much the spontaneous, lower the spontaneous quit rate, how much higher the relapse rate might be in psychiatric populations. Another area that I think is wide open for help is what is the effect of smoking cessation on cost. We have two kinds of studies that are available to us now for that parameter. One is that are model-based, that people say, well, we know at what rates smoking leads to illnesses like heart disease and cancer, and we know the cost of those, and so we'll estimate what that avoided cost will be. Well, they're not actually based on any estimates of what happens when people quit or comparing quitters to non-quitters. The second study looks at and compares the costs of former smokers to current smokers, and invariably find that former smokers, in the short run anyway, have higher costs than current smokers, and conclude that smoking cessation leads to higher costs in the short term. And, you know, that's the best parameter that we have, but I think that it's that there's a problem with that information. And that is, it's well established that poor health leads people to quit smoking. And so that short-term extra cost of former smokers is probably just the confounding of, you know, they had poor health to begin with, and it's the thing that led them to quit. And so it's not the effect of quitting smoking. It's the effect of the illness that caused them to quit smoking. So we really need an analysis that thinks about what's the effect of smoking cessation in the short run on cost that controls for this selection bias. And then the mortality data, there are obviously a lot of data on the studies on the risk of mortality, the attributable tobacco use, but none of it that, or very little that is specific to psychiatric populations. And we had to kind of combine studies to make sense out of that and for our model. The other thing to point out is that there are some mixed recommendations on whether we should exclude costs of health care that are attributed to longer survival. So people who quit smoking live longer, they live longer and incur more health care costs. Some recommendations say we exclude those extra costs, but it's not such a simple thing to do. And that would, had we done that, would have made all our cost-effectiveness ratios smaller. We did include them. So I'd just like to conclude with kind of three observations. You know, the direct cost of smoking cessation services is a thing we need to measure carefully. The other healthcare costs, we found that they weren't affected by treatment group assignment, and as I indicated, they're just so noisy they drown out the signal from the first kind of cost. But the cost-effectiveness guidelines say we should be gathering these data. So that's, and, you know, we continue to do so, but I will just observe that many smoking models ignore these other healthcare costs, at least in the, altogether, lifetime, over lifetime. Would be nice to have some better data to build our models. So that's what I have. I wondered, Jean, if we have had any questions.
Yes, there are a few questions that have come in. So there's some questions about your methods. So what program did you use to run the Markov models?
I have used TreeH, and it's a great program. It's requires an annual license, and it has been a little problem in the VA environment to get the funding necessary to keep that license up to date. There is a free program called Decision Maker that many people like to use, partly because then anyone can use Decision Maker to, you know, work with your model and evaluate it. But it, there's a, it's not nearly as user friendly as TreeH. Those are the only programs, dedicated programs to decision modeling that I am aware of. There may be others, but those are the only two I know about. It. And TreeH is just far away better to use, but of course you have to pay for it. Some people build models with Excel. I think that is makes it awful hard on the analyst. You have to do all the programming and then, you know, more prone to error. So if you've got the funding for your project, I would recommend getting TreeH.
Another question asks, what is your opinion of using the EQ5D as a quality of life measure? And do you have any opinion in regards to the various quality of life measures as being better than the others?
The definitive answer is that HERC has a guidebook on that question about how do you find the quality of life instrument for your study. And that's on our website, and please write to HERC at va.gov if you have trouble locating it. So that really tells you how to find it. I think that it is important to the approach that I have used in the past in a new trial is to say, has anyone used this measure in this kind of this patient population, and if so, then I would have some slight preference to using that. So the EQ5D is widely used, not surprising in Europe because that E stands for European, and has kind of become a standard partly because it's so brief. Up until recently, there haven't been any U.S. norms, but now there are U.S. norms for it. I think that because it's brief, it has some problems at the extreme end of the distribution, especially at the top, that a lot of people ceiling out. HUI, the Health Utilities Index, is more extensive and has more questions and doesn't have that same problem. There are more possible answers, and so if you can afford the extra time with your patients, it's probably a better method. But if you're in the situation where you're trying to convince your collaborators to, you know, put something in, then EQ5D would be better than not having the EQ5D. The quality of well-being is kind of the third in the running, and we have used it in a couple studies because we think it does better in the psychiatric populations. But that, I'm not sure how well, it's just been used more in psychiatric populations, so we think maybe that's a good reason to prefer it. That is the, there's a quality of well-being interview, and there is a quality well-being short form, and we're talking about the short form. Those are really the only three off-the-shelf methods that are essentially,
there's a related question. Did you find the utility surveys sensitive and valid for your smoking health states? So you had the former and the current smokers.
So we never found a significant difference in health between current and former smokers within the time of the trial. And I think that, now that said, there is a... we used parameters from a very large study that was done in the United Kingdom of looking at primary care patients that established the difference between current and former smokers' utility. So in the trials, we didn't observe anything statistically significant, but in terms of our modeling, we used the information from that English study, which said, here is what, over the long run, what the benefit of quitting smoking is on quality of life. In the short run, we didn't see anything. Maybe that has that effect of the, you know, illness leading to quitting. So that could, contradict that benefit.
Okay. There were also a couple of specific questions about trial number 3 that you described. So this person wanted to know, did you assess antidepressant treatment response with depression rating scale, like the HAM-D, to see if that correlated with quit rates?
I'm sure that
patients more likely to quit.
We did gather the depression outcomes, and so the question is, did that correlate with, did the people who quitting having
more or less depression symptoms?
Depression symptoms. So I don't think there was any depression benefit. I'd have to go back and look at the main paper, and if the person would send me the. Well, I have listed in these next, these are the three trials, and so that 2008 paper that appeared in Addiction is, that cites the main paper which answers that question definitively. and I'm my
okay.
But my recollection is that that certainly the in all of these studies that the randomization did not worsen psychiatric outcomes. Did quitting result in better psychiatric outcomes?
Well, this person made a comment that bupropion is also an effective antidepressant. So if that patient received that in addition to another antidepressant, that might have impacted the outcome.
It might have, but in all of these trials, very few people received anything other than nicotine replacement therapy. There's just a handful of folks in each trial that got another pharmacotherapy. But and in fact, in the PTSD study, it became quite controversial because it was designed, this cooperative study, to use essentially care, usual pharmacotherapy, and it became quite controversial that varenicline or Chantix had been used in patients with PTSD for no good reason. There was a concern that this was inappropriate because there are some risks that have been noted for varenicline.
Okay. So this person wants to know whether your methods were published. So here's a list of your publications. She also wants to know whether you had code examples.
So the code, are they talking about the decision model?
I believe so. Maybe that person could write in if that's not. Yes, she says yes.
Yeah, is it because, so, you know, we have written, you know, SAS programs to analyze the data. I don't think they would be translatable to another study. The decision models are documented in supplementary appendices for the first two papers and also for the trial that I alluded to but did not really present on the fifth trial, which was on the older primary care patients, extended smoking cessation for older primary care patients. So we have details of the model, but no, we don't. I haven't shared with anyone yet the triage files, and I'm not sure that they would be very easy for you to apply to another study.
Okay.
But I'm happy to talk to somebody about that if they need to get started.
Okay, great. And then somebody asked, given that the most expensive cessation intervention was well below the $100,000 threshold of acceptability, do you think it is still worthwhile to investigate ways to improve cost effectiveness of smoking cessation interventions?
I think the question is, I don't think what we really need to do, and I think maybe I should have said, maybe the important lesson is about all this is that the last group of untreated smokers or undertreated smokers are the ones who have psychiatric illness. That they've been ignored by the smoking cessation services community in the past, partly because of these ideas that they will be difficult to treat or that maybe we will make their psychiatric condition worse, and that really that now becomes is the current focus and is a focus for VA now to focus on those folks, both patients with PTSD and also folks who are in rehab treatment. There are a lot of different efforts now to reach those smokers because those are the ones that most difficult to reach and you know, have the big problem. So I think that as we expand into these new populations, the challenge is going to be, you know, we need to show even when we're reaching smokers that are more difficult to treat that it's still cost effective.
I just was curious, in any of your trials, did you happen to find that there were certain characteristics of the patients, like certain patients were more resistant to quitting? And did you look at their specific, more mental health comorbidities and things like that made them more resistant to quitting?
Yeah, I don't. So the subgroup analyses are always interesting to do in clinical trials, but usually we don't. You know, we're right at the threshold of proving anything for the intervention groups as a whole, let alone subgroups. The one thing that I think is interesting, so the alcohol trial, the people who had better alcohol outcomes were also more likely to quit. So that's interesting. And there's another trial that I haven't mentioned yet that I'm involved in, which was in people with HIV. And the folks who were better adherents with their HIV medications were more likely to quit. So there's a kind of, there seems to be some sort of, concern about health seems to be correlate in that way. People who are ready to take action on their health in one area are ready to do so in another area. So that, I think, is... But you can also see that the quit rates are different in these different populations.
So it might have to do with their underlying characteristics.
Yeah, I would say that, so your question is who's more likely to quit and who's less likely to quit?
And were there just some who are just very resistant to quitting?
Did I see it in the trial? So I have another study that is being written up, where we have looked at the, and I'm going to present, which I'm going to present in July, but so here's a teaser, which is we have data from 3 years from the corporate data warehouse on the health factors database. We've identified the smoking status of more than a million veterans, and we've looked at quit rates in veterans who are current smokers, and we've looked at relapse rates and veterans who are former smokers, and we definitely see which factors and which illnesses are associated with more likely for current smokers to quit. And basically, if you have a medical illness, you're more likely to quit, and if you have a psychiatric illness, you're less likely to quit. And conversely, with relapse, that relapse is more common in psychiatric illness of former smokers, and relapse is less common with medical illness. So I'm giving oral presentation early July at the HSR&D meeting, if you're going.
So that's a little plug for Paul's future presentation at HSR&D.
That's right.
I want to thank you very much for your great presentation today. Heidi, did you want to give any final last words?
As I close things out today, you will be prompted for a feedback form. If you all could take just a few moments and fill that out. We do use this as a metric for all of our series, so even if you have filled one out in the past, we really would appreciate you doing it again for this session. It does take a few moments, and we really do read through all of your feedback. I want to thank everyone for joining us for today's HSR&D Cyber Seminar, and we hope to see you at a future session. Thank you.